Hello, folks, and welcome back to Chris Wyatt Reports. It's Colonel Chris Wyatt live in central Pennsylvania with special guests today. And my featured guest today is none other than Dr. John LaBond. I've never asked you if that's the correct way to pronounce it. Is it LaBond or do you say LaBand or how do you say it?
I said LaBand, though it's really a German name, so it's LaBand, I suppose. But anyway.
Okay, LaBand. Okay, well, we want to make sure we do our best to get it correct. It's a lot easier than some of the Zulu names and the Xhosa names, but to say the least. But Dr. LaBand is a subject matter expert on the history of the Zulu and the 19th century and African conflicts, and well, throughout the Southern Africa region. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's get started. For my international audience, your background's a little grainy, but that's a thatched roof behind you. A very stereotypical sort of a historical dwelling in South Africa, is it not?
Well, it is, except it's a fire risk insurance thing nowadays, so they're less popular than they used to be.
Okay, fair enough. So what we're going to talk about today is your recent book, which I picked up on my trip to South Africa in January and all of February when I was there. And this book is The Boer... Oops, that's not going to come out very well. I've got this. I got to do it here because I got the green screen on. The Boer Invasion of Zulu Kingdom, 1837-1840. Now, you've written, published, edited, contributed to over two dozen books throughout your long academic career. Where does this book stand from a personal perspective? Is it one of your favorites or one of the most difficult you worked on? Can you tell us a little bit about the book from that perspective?
Yeah, it's one I wanted to do for a long time, in fact, because I, at one stage in my life, once apartheid fell, I was invited to be part of a committee that was looking, in fact, at the whole problems of monuments and their place in a new South Africa and Blood River or the Ngome, which is this Battle of Blood River, is a very, very contentious one indeed. And so I sat on this committee and one tried to sort of work out a new way of trying to sort of see this conflict in a way that's not just the old Boer perspective, the old colonial perspective, but one that had a Zulu perspective as well. And this is years ago, this is in the late 1990s. And ever since that, I thought I'd have loved to write about the whole thing and to try and give it my particular spin. And this is an opportunity that came up.
Well, speaking along those lines, you know, it's interesting because so far as the history of the Zulu side, because there's everyone has a side to the conversation, but the Zulu side, was it challenging for historians given that there were so few written records at the time? Much of what we know, if I'm not mistaken, comes from oral history taken from veterans of these battles and of this time frame around the 1890s. Did that present a challenge?
Well, this is right. And I think it's only fairly recently that the James Stewart Archive, a recorded oral Zulu testimony, actually became available. And that certainly has been a major source for me, because here were people, many veterans of the war itself, or the sons or grandsons of those who had taken part. So this did give one a Zulu perspective. The problem is, if you speak to present-day Zulus, I mean, it's asking about, I mean, well, you can imagine asking somebody, what do you know about a war in the 1830s? The answer is really not that much, you know. So one is dependent on this recorded oral testimony, of which, thank goodness, there is a fair amount. And of course, the observations of those from the other side, not necessarily from the Boers, but from travelers like Adolf de la Gorgue, who's a French traveler and hunter who sort of picked up and was able to look at the whole scene and make his comments about it, people like that. So we do have, you know, voices or views, at least outside those from the main protagonists.
Well, presumably some of those other voices at the time would have been missionaries who were active in the region as well from throughout the world.
Yes, not that many missionaries in this part of the world, in fact. You had Erasmus Schmidt, who was, well, a sort of pseudo-missionary with the Boers. I mean, he wasn't really sort of, you know, properly in the church, but I mean, he was, you know,
He
was there and he took services and stuff. He was there and he kept a diary, which is jolly useful. And you had Captain Alan Gardner, who was indeed a missionary in the area, but he left before the war actually began. So, but you do have people like Owen, who was another missionary who was actually at Mgungundlovu and was actually able to watch the killing of Retief and his fellow and his fellows on that embassy. So you do have some of these outside visions, as voices as well, yes.
Well, as far as now, as a historian, a fellow historian, this is something that often comes up. People try to poo-poo or discount the oral testimony of people when it comes to history. And there are reasons for that. Let's be fair. I mean, yeah. memories get clouded. We tend to remember what went well and what we did well and not the things we failed at. And we oftentimes tend to look back on the good old days, so to speak, when things were better. But that said, oral history can, in fact, prove to be a very valuable resource. You know, the Icelandic sagas were dismissed for a long time, and come to find out with archaeological research, there's a lot of truth. Obviously, not, you know, two-headed dragons and stuff like that. But there's a lot of truth to the sagas. Would you agree that oral history, despite sometimes getting a bad reputation, is a very valuable source for historical research and writing?
Oh, it's absolutely essential. I mean, in a continent like Africa, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, there is very little written record, or the written record is indeed recorded testimony of one sort or another. But what I find interesting about the oral testimony about a war like this is that Blood River, which is the great climactic battle, there's very little about that in the Zulu recorded testimony. On the other hand, a subsequent battle, the Battle of the White Mfolozi or Apartheid, where the Zulus actually won, there's a great deal of recorded evidence about that. So people's memories, indeed, you remember the good things and you try, you brush the bad ones under the carpet. Yeah.
Well, the Battle of the White Mfolozi, I'm not at all surprised Zulu remember that, because as I recall, the Boers decided to go try to just end this thing once and for all. And they got snookered. Hey, there's a bunch of cattle down here. Seemed a little too enticing for the Boer leaders, and they fell for it and had their head handed to them. Is that an accurate description of the summary of the battle? Yeah.
Well, that's absolutely it. And in fact, the Zulu were deliberately walking around, or at least crouching around with their cowhide shields on their
backs.
Like cattle from a distance, yeah. But I mean, you know, so that war actually didn't end with a great victory of Blood River. It actually ended with a defeat. And then the Boers retreated, and the war actually ended then with a negotiated peace for the time being. You know, it was a kind of stalemate, in fact.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, the thing that's always puzzled, I think, people not very familiar with what happened in what was Natal and the Zulu land at the time, is that most of the Boers, not long after this, already by the 1850s, had abandoned Natal and moved into the Highveld. They moved back over the Drakensberg up into the Free State and what became the South African Republic, or the Transvaal, abandoning it for a variety of reasons. But I mean, if it was a great victory, you'd think there'd be an established kingdom, or not kingdom, but an established state there, which was only briefly a state, and then it disappeared pretty quickly after 2 years.
Well, the reason really for that is the sort of the factor off the stage for half of that, and that is Britain and the Cape Colony and the British imperial interests. That, you know, it's something we often get wrong about the British Empire. They were actually dragged into the interior by their subjects from the Cape, actually marching off, causing great ructions among the people of the interior, which threatened to destabilize the borders of the Cape. I mean, as far as the British were concerned, the Cape was an important strategic point on the way to India. And what happened?
And that's it.
I mean, diamonds hadn't been discovered yet. Gold hadn't been discovered yet. There was nothing except a lot of trouble in the interior. So the British were there, and there was this troublesome community of hunter traders at Port Natal, nowadays Durban, who had settled on the coast of the Zulu kingdom and had this rather fraught relationship with the Zulu monarch, and were constantly trying to get the British to come in and actually annex them, to raise the flag. And the British were saying, forget it, absolutely not. But it's only once the Boers had set up their republic and were then pushing further south against the eastern frontier of the Cape that the British thought, really, this is too much. This is really, really troublesome. We're going to have to stop it. And so it's the British intervention that actually pushes the Boers out. But I mean, right in the beginning, the Boers had divided. Half of them had stayed in the Highveld. Only some of them went down into Natal. So you went back and joined your brothers, so to speak, over the Drakensberg.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mention that, because not to defend the Brits, certainly not my place here, but it's not the first time, and it's not uncommon for this sort of thing to happen. I mean, we look at what happened in Virginia. We see that the British government established a line of demarcation in which white settlers could not go any further west. And Because they were extended no protections, and the groups west of there, the indigenous population, were afforded their freedoms. But the land proved to be too lucrative with bison and great hunting grounds and farmland. And so white settlers poured across the Appalachians into Kentucky, into Tennessee, and they got attacked. And then they screamed for help from the crown and then later from the American government, dragging both of those governments into that against the Native Americans there, who they had no desire to. Yeah. And then it's not just that. I mean, Carl Peters in German Southwest Africa tried years to get Bismarck to annex an African colony. Eventually it happened, but it was not because of his good offices. It was for other reasons.
No, exactly. So no, it's precisely the same situation. Yep.
So the situation in Natal with the Boers who came down there. Now this, okay. Now I'm going to sound like a rube here, but this is for my audience. Okay. If you travel South Africa and you drive around, you discover that there's actually more favorable terrain northeast of the Drakensberg. The Drakensberg are in the view behind me here, by the way, folks. That's the northern reach of the Drakensberg.
You recognize
that. If you go a little further north, you can go around and you can come down in Natal without too much difficulty and epic struggling of oxen up over the high mountains and such. Is there a reason why they just didn't go a little further north and come down? Or because the stories were told, or is this mythology about the Trek Boer columns going through the Drakensberg, disassembling their weapons, piece by piece, coming down the other side? When if you go a little further north, I mean, I realize the Van Rienen Pass isn't the easiest to get through, but it's a heck of a lot easier than what you see behind me.
Well, further north, there's one simple word, malaria.
Well, not that far north.
that's where Louis Trichardt and others went through originally. I mean, one possibility was trying to make connection with Delagoa Bay and the Portuguese as an outlet to trade and for their very important items like gunpowder, coffee, and other necessities for Boer life. Further north around the north of the Drakensberg, sure, it is somewhat easier. But then they hadn't actually explored that particular part yet. I mean, and they'd already run into trouble with people like the Kluge and others. There were other polities there as well. I mean, they're the Basutu, they're the Kluge, they're the Klokwa. There are all sorts of people living around that part of the world. I mean, so the Drakensberg seemed the most direct route over, and it just seemed the one they took. Indeed, I mean, where they did cross wasn't that far from going around the north, or around Harrismith, etc. But that's the route they seem to have taken, where their scouts discovered these routes, and that's what they decided on.
Oh, I'm just saying, if I was Pete Ice or Put Geeter, I might have hired better scouts. Huh? I would have gone slightly further north.
Further north and then come in.
Come in from that side. It would have been a little bit easier. Yeah, but you're right. But there were a lot of polities there. And of course, this is a consequence of people actually being from the area and settled there for centuries, as well as Mfukane, which it had a big impact on dispersing people throughout the region. And that plays into the historical narrative of the Afrikaner and the Trek Boers is walking into largely empty spaces in what was the Free State. But that wasn't a natural consequence. It was a consequence of the Mfukane and the turmoil that happened there, was it not?
Yes or no is my answer. Because what one forgets is that Africa at that stage was still enormously underpopulated.
Sure.
The populations are very small. I mean, the Zulu kingdom, how many subjects do they have? 250,000 at the outside.
And that was big.
And that was big. You're looking at some of these smaller people on the Highveld, 50,000, 30,000, 40,000, quite small numbers. And so you've got these small groups anyway, and you have a countryside where lots of it's actually not much use for agriculture, or indeed doesn't have the optimum grazing, winter and summer grazing for your herds either. So those areas you actually can settle are fairly small. So you find people are congregate around the best bits, leaving lots of empty space in between. But then, of course, what has happened, this kind of this ricocheting effect of state building, pushing other people out, migrating, hitting communities, forcing them off. So that has certainly led to a lot of not so much empty land, but land temporarily abandoned while people sort of took refuge in mountains, et cetera, et cetera. So as far as the Boers are concerned, it was pretty unpopulated, but they didn't quite get the right impression. But then you've got the Ndebele Kingdom, which is one of the major sort of migratory states that are pushed out of the Zululand area and now into the Highveld. And they deliberately created a sort of cordon sanitaire around their kingdom to keep enemy raiders out, kind of empty space, which they deliberately forced empty for their own security. So, yeah. So as I say, yes and no is the answer.
Well, and of course, Mzilikazi and the Ndebele preyed upon their neighbors. They love that cordon sanitaire because it gave them space to maneuver as they attacked. And in fact, you know, when I talked to Afrikaners, a lot of times you talk to Afrikaners today that want to self-divide and isolate, which seems to be a big part of the history of that people. One of the things I tell them is you have a lot of natural allies. I mean, just go back in your history here. In order to unite against Mzilikazi, you had the Borlaug, you had the Griquas who were in the area. You also had Basutu peoples, Tswana peoples who allied, at least on a an alliance of convenience, if nothing else, to go and raid and attack Mzilikazi to stop that and eventually chase them north of the Limpopo. So, you know, it's an interesting story for me that people seem to forget history, that this history is intertwined, and it's with black South Africans and white South Africans who at times fought each other and at times actually worked together.
Well, this is right. I mean, it's the Drosters, to give them their basic name, you know, of these people on the Highveld who were people of mixed race, either from slaves or the local Khoisan population, who dressed like Boers. They fought like Boers. They had wagons. They had houses.
They were Dutch Calvinists. They spoke Afrikaans.
all the rest of it. So when the Boers actually arrived, they were sort of like yet another element of the same on the Highveld. But I think, you know, what you say is very true, that in colonial situations, one always forgets it's not always the colonizers against the rest. It's always a question of the colonizers with a lot of the indigenous people against other indigenous people. Whether you start with Cortes against the Aztecs, the story, you know, with his allies.
There's no way that he would have won with that handful of people. It wasn't for thousands of other Mesoamericans who were angry at the Aztecs.
And I mean, the Sixth Cape Frontier War, which really is sort of one of the main reasons the Boers left the Eastern Cape. I mean, there, the Mfengu and other people were major figures on the side of the British. And when the Boers left, it wasn't an all-white party. They went with not only all their herds, but all their retainers, some of whom were ex-slaves, some of whom were not. And in many of the battles that were fought, you had lots of people of color actually fighting with the Boers against the Zulu, and especially the Port Natal hunter traders. They had a large force of armed followers, if you like, who were in fact local Zulu. You know, so it is a very mixed bag.
No, I think it's an important consideration when people talk about South African history, because of the history of the National Party and the policy of apartheid. People look at everything through a lens of racism, and there may have been disparaging. There may have been elements of racism back in the time, but aside from that, people still work together and against each other for whatever their purposes were.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely so. I mean, if we move later to the Anglo-Zulu War, which is sort of so well known, I mean, there is many Natal Africans fighting with the British as there were British soldiers, you know. So
absolutely. Well, we're jumping around a bit here, but I think if the audience is finding it enjoyable, I hope you're enjoying the conversation. I know I am. So we'll skip past Dingane, or as I prefer to call him, Dingane. I grew up saying Dingane, but we'll skip past Dingane. We can always come back to him and Piet Retief and Blauwkrans and all that later. But I want to go to the Battle of Blood River, Nkome, that battle that took place. Now, a lot of people look at this as, you know, because it's part of the story or the mythology, however you prefer to view it, of what was built up as they were attacked by the Zulu. But both sides were itching for a fight, it seems, in this battle. The Boers went, this wasn't a typical, you know, wagon train. This was men who were ready to fight, and they were prepared. They came prepared. They even brought some, you know, some artillery with them, some small artillery. And they were looking for the Zulu for a decisive engagement. And the Zulu were looking to stop them and blunt them and chase them back. I mean, it's really, in the military, we have a term called a meeting engagement. And really, I would describe this as a meeting engagement. Both armies out looking, scouts trying to find, and it's zero in, and then you have a beat. Was that accurate?
It is. And for a certain way, it is a rather desperate situation for the Zulu, because just earlier in the year, in August, they had fought the Battle of Fechla, where the Boers were in their strongly, really entrenched encampment. And in 2.5, nearly 3 days of fighting, They tried again and again against this fortified all-round position, and it failed to break through. So there is this knowledge that if the Boers, in their normal, when you're on commando, you've got your wagons, you're going to be lagering as they're doing the whole way, they knew this was going to be incredibly difficult, you know, having lost one battle already, fought that way. On the other hand, they had to stop the Boers because they were homing in on Mgungukhlova, which was the King Dingaan's capital. So indeed, there had to be a meeting. There had to be a desperate effort to make it work. And they certainly put together the biggest army they put together in the entire war. They threw everything they had at this, basically.
And it appears almost, look, I mean, the Zulu weren't stupid. They knew that the lager was in these circumstances with these opposing forces, the most effective means to engage for the Boers. It really was. It gave them the ability to just, you know, sit back defended and just, you know, mobile fortress essentially that allowed them to attack their opponent. So the Zulu weren't stupid. They knew that it was going to be tough. And I suspect they anticipated heavy losses, but as you said, it was desperation. They had to do something, and this is where they chose to engage.
Yeah. I mean, one of the problems is, as so often with Zulu attacks, it became uncoordinated, if you like. The left wing moved in advance of the right. But even so, I don't think that made that much of a difference because, you know, we look at the disparity of numbers, you know, thousands against hundreds, and yet the actual defensive perimeter is very small. So if the Zulu had 100 men or 10,000 men, there were still only going to be 100 men facing that actual.
Right. They're tripping over each other, and there's only so much space to advance.
Now, that's right. And certainly in the later stage of the battle, you get those in the front trying to push back and those behind pushing forward and, you know, trampling each other and all the rest of it. So yeah, I mean, larger numbers make no difference in that kind of situation. I mean, in a standard battle, in the open field, so to speak, where you're trying to envelop the enemy and surround them. Yeah, sure. I mean, larger numbers play a part, but not in this kind of defensive situation. It's like the Battle of Rorke's Drift or whatever, you know, to look ahead to the Anglo-Zulu War, you know.
Exactly. Well, that's what I was going to get at. You know, you see Chard and you see Bromville. Chard takes the mealy bags and all the sandbags and piles them up. And basically, they wind up with automatic weapons fire, in essence, first rank fire, second rank fire, third rank, first rank fire. And, you know, it was absolutely brilliant. But, I mean, it was desperation. It was either that or die. So, I mean, neither one of them had particularly illustrious military careers after that, but they did get the Victoria Cross for that action.
Well, they did. Like rats in a trap, as they say, they had to fight. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in this case at Blood River, not only was the lager effective, but it was, if you look at the terrain today, it was pretty well situated. Although where the bronze wagon are, aren't the exact spot.
But it's not quite right.
Right. Yeah, but you see the bend, you see the banks of that river, and you can see it's also kind of fast flowing at the right time of year. I don't know how it was on that day, but that's a tough spot.
And it was fast flowing. I mean, it had been very, very rainy, in fact, for a long time. So the river was full. And I mean, so basically the lager, only two sides of it, two of the four sides effectively were open to attack. The rest were protected by the river and the large donga or gully or whatever in along the other side. So it was very well placed indeed.
Well, in fact, at one stage, if not throughout the day, because it started in the morning and went till early afternoon, I think. Yeah. But at one stage, the Boers had, you know, it was like a turkey shoot. There were so many Zulu trapped in the river trying to cross or cower down there to hide from fire. Yeah. Withering fire came and probably killed dozens, if not hundreds more Zulu in the river.
No, surely. I mean, it was, and we know that they were trying to hide under the water and breathing through reeds and all the rest of it. Yeah, but so, and I mean, and the whole point about battles like this is not just defending against the attack; it's the moment you can counterattack and open up the wagon line and let out your mounted men, you know, and that turns a repulse into a rout, and that's where much of the killing takes place in those kind of pursuits.
Well, in fact, and you see if you look at the Anglo-Boer War, you'll see some battles where an awful lot of the people who were shot in the back as they fled away from besieging.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy stuff. So let me ask you this question about the Zulu, because I mean, your book is very interesting, very fascinating from the standpoint that you spend a fair amount of time in here describing the culture of the Zulu Kingdom, all the different pieces and parts of it, the settlements, the King's Kraal, all the different attendees and attendees. tenders and all the different things. What I found very interesting in the book was that, because I learned some things from that, because I'm not that deeply steeped in the inner workings of the Zulu kingdom. But one thing that's always struck me is that the nature of the kingdom that Shaka formed and the growth of the Zulu is that they were structured in such a way that it almost seems like they had to be militaristic and expansionist. Otherwise, they couldn't keep their impis busy, and there was always a chance they would turn on and the whole thing would fall apart. Is it a reasonable assessment to say that the Zulu Empire at that stage in the 1830s, 1840s had to be militaristic and had to raid their enemies for cattle and to grow so they could hand out spoils and patronage to keep the king in power, or the whole thing might have fallen apart politically?
Yes, I think, look, it's just like the Ottoman Empire later on, and earlier, I mean, in the 15th and 16th century, which was constantly expanding, and that's how it worked. And once it reached limits, the thing began to sort of implode in on itself. So, yeah, I mean, the Zulu kingdom definitely depended on gathering tribute, attacking your enemies, I mean, rewarding your chief men and all the rest of it. So it was supposed to be continually expand, not even so much expanding, but being able to raid and attack neighbors to bring in the cattle and which is absolutely necessary for the kingdom to go on. So it is a military kingdom. It's created as a military kingdom. It's the most militarized in the neighborhood. And that's how it actually continues. I mean, that's sort of its being, in fact.
You know, well, yeah, absolutely. In fact, most of its rulers, not all, but most of its rulers disappeared from the scene by being murdered or assassinated until later on. Yeah. It was in Pandey the first that actually lived out his natural life?
He was, in fact. I mean, even today, I mean, the latest Zulu king here, that succession was hugely contested, except they went to the Supreme Court. They didn't kill each other. Well, they went to law instead.
There's definitely an improvement from that standpoint. We've turned to the courts instead of to the Asagai. Yeah. But yikes. No, I just can't. But, you know, back to Blood River. I went there before the Friendship Bridge was erected. You had to drive all the way around to get. And I did. Yeah. I made the effort to drive all the way around to get to the Zulu side, which was quite a headache. Yeah. It was quite a nice and impressive site when it was first built, that building. And I really liked it because it showed both sides, and there may have been animosity, but as a tourist traveling there or as a historian, I wasn't seeing it openly, the animosity at the time. It was more of a reconciliation. The bridge is lovely, but I was just there in February, late January, excuse me. And it's the first time I've been there in two decades or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. The bridge is lovely, but the Zulu site is largely being ignored. I don't know if it's because it's financed by the government at national level or provincial level or what. It's not dilapidated, but it looks like it hasn't been maintained in those 20 years.
Maintained, yeah.
And in addition, they all absconded. No one was there. It was open hours and there wasn't a damn person anywhere at the site. I wanted to go and look around. I could walk around inside, but I wanted to talk to people and there was no one working. They're just, I don't know if they're getting paid, but they weren't there. It's very disappointing.
It is, but I mean, it's unfortunately rather symptomatic of the way things operate nowadays, in fact. And I mean, the bridge itself was supposed to be built right at the beginning.
Yeah, and it wasn't.
We won't go into the scandals about why it wasn't, but it wasn't.
But it came later. But, you know, it's not just there. I also went to Isandlwana, and I hadn't been there in some time either. And I'm actually heart sore as a historian about the dilapidated state of that battle site. The plaque or scene that's there, it sits on a little, you know, metal legs, and it's about 2 meters by 3 meters, and it depicts the battle. You can't see it. The plastic covering it is washed out completely. Yeah. And everywhere on the battlefield, that's the situation. The only thing that looks like it's fresh is they repaint the rocks where the cairns are every so often. Yeah. I mean, this is an epic victory for the Zulu people when they just wiped out that entire column. You'd think the Zulu people would have enough pride in their history that maybe they would do it on their own if it's not the government.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's lack of funding. It's just, as I say, symptomatic of so much else.
Look, I'm not throwing stones at the Zulu, but I mean, by contrast, the folks that run the Voortrekker Monument also are responsible for the Boer side of the Blood River Memorial, and they maintain both of those. They're not funded with one penny from the government. I mean, you know, I think the Zulu people should, you know, try to, obviously a lot of Zulu people live in poverty, let's be honest about that. But I mean, somebody ought to step up who's a prominent Zulu and say, hey, this is our heritage. We should be taking care of this.
I know. And I mean, in fact, I mean, annually things of events happen at Santlawan and all the rest of it. So you would think so. But I mean, it's been a problem for years and years, these sites. Vandalism and all the rest of it's always been a part of the name of the game. And yeah, and it's just, yeah, so many of our monuments are in that state. And I mean, So that's, as I say, where we are.
Yeah, no, I'm always of the opinion that rather than tearing down monuments, let's build more monuments. And in this case, yeah. I think they should build more monuments. But now, the nature of the Zulu kingdom at this time is, you know, I think for some respects for the board, maybe they didn't realize the situation they were in. And you can give me your assessment of my analysis here. They seem to think they could go and wipe out the Zulu kingdom and that be it. But the King's Kraal was really mobile. They would pick it up and move if they needed to. And in fact, did do that several times. Yeah. So I think the only way you could have taken out the Zulus is decisively defeat the king, which would lose to a loss of face and maybe, you know, execute him. But you couldn't just attack their capital and destroy the Zulu. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it is. And in fact, in a way, what wrecked Dingaan's efforts to move was he was moving north into the Swazi kingdom, hoping to take over that, and lost a major battle, the Battle of Lubuya, which that really put an end to it, because there's nowhere for him to go, having been so badly defeated in that particular battle. So in a way, you can argue what brought Dingaan and the old Zulu kingdom down wasn't so much the Boer victory as a defeat by the Swazi, you know?
Well, essentially, because the Zulu for a long time actually coveted the Swazi kingdom. They wanted that. Didn't they? They sent parties up there to try to engage them. And then when they were looking to get away from the Boers or move, they actually sent scouts up to what at the time was Lourenco Marx in today's Mozambique, now Maputo. Yeah. And of course, that's a malaria zone.
And indeed, I mean, Chaga's great campaign in 1829. Enormous casualties had moved into that particular region. But the Zulu kept on raiding the Swazi kingdom way up into the 1850s, in fact, on a regular basis. They're the sort of traditional enemy. They're the hunting ground, if you like, you know, and that carried on.
But they never decisively defeated them.
No. One reason is that the Swazi were very good at taking to their caves and defending them, not in fact engaging in set piece battles. And what's unusual about Lubuya is that for once they decided on a great set piece battle and actually won it, you know. So that was against the grain, if you like.
Well, that was a bit unusual, but of course that meant the end of Dingaan. That was it for him.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And those who were left after that horrific defeat, most of them just eventually found their way back south and came back because there really wasn't anything for them there.
Yeah. Indeed. And of course, in the end, I mean, what really brings Dingaan to an end is a civil war against his brother Mpande, who joins up with the Boers, wins a battle, defeats Dingaan, and is then recognized as the new Zulu king. So he did a good deal.
Well, in fact, as you mentioned earlier, it wasn't the Boers who took out Dingaan. It was, in fact, Mpande and the Zulu themselves.
Yeah. That's right. I mean that particular battle, I mean, effectively was Zulu against Zulu. The Boers were on a commando, which was actually busy collecting cattle and other loot, and never actually got to the battlefield. So it was a Zulu on Zulu affair. Yeah,
they were lingering and not moving with any alacrity.
No, they were certainly lingering and drinking and having a good party and collecting cattle. Yeah,
and let the Zulu go about the business of killing each other.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's a plan if you're in charge.
Yep. And I mean, then they gathered in lots of apprentices, as they caused their little, you know, well, effectively slaves, which they took as well, you know. So, yeah.
Well, let's go back kind of to the beginning and the story, which has become an, I don't want to say mythology, although people who disparagingly call it mythology, but certainly the narrative, the story of the Trek Boers and the Afrikaner nation being forged. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, goes back to them coming across the Drakensberg mm-hmm. and coming down into Natal and Zululand. Mm-hmm. And meeting up with Dingaan and asking if this is a story, asking if they could, you know, settle on the land. And he said, well, sure. I want you to go do me a favor, though. You got to recover these cattle that were stolen from us, which apparently was years ago or something like that. Anyway. And so they went on a punitive raid and they collected cattle and they brought it back and they all had a feast and had a good time and supposedly signed a treaty. And then they came back to celebrate the treaty. And, you know, I think I try to put myself in the shoes of Pete Retief's party. Yeah. When you walk into the King's Crawl, and look, I mean, you can elaborate on this in a moment. I know they did all sorts of things, either intentionally or more likely probably unintentionally, of insulting the Zulus with their customs and being abusive in ways they probably didn't even realize, but which really kind of put them at a disadvantage, and I don't think they realized that. But I try to put myself in the shoes of Pete Retief and the guys who went in there, like, okay, no, you have to leave your weapons out here. It's a sign of respect for the king. And then you're suddenly surrounded by all these people in a kingdom that's very militaristic. Either they're very naive or they were very arrogant. I'm not sure which it was, but to get yourself in that situation, I don't know that I would have joined Retief's party going for the signing of the treaty.
I think arrogance as much as anything else, though naivety, certainly. I think, you know, you're looking at two parties with rather different visions.
And different worldviews.
And different worldviews. You've got Retief coming in, and they feel they can do a deal and negotiate land, and that's that. From the Zulu perspective, I mean, they are a conquering people. This is their world. And suddenly, over the Drakensberg, or at the wrong part of the Drakensberg, for the Drakensberg anyway, come 1,000 wagons and tens of thousands of livestock,
weapons,
of people, and of course carrying all these weapons. And they arrive and they settle down and immediately start gathering food from the various homesteads.
Well, because let me interrupt you, John, for a second there, because a lot of the people were fearful when they arrived, say when they're at the base of the Drakensberg, and they fled and they'd had food stores of grain, and they found them like, oh, these are abandoned, we can take it,
right, exactly. So in other words, as from the Zulu perspective, they're going on as if they've conquered this land and they're living here. You know, who do they think they are? On the other hand, Dingaan is no fool. He's absolutely aware that these same Boers have defeated the Indibele, who the Zulu have never succeeded in defeating, but the Boers have, and they've chased them, you know, chased them north. So here are an extremely dangerous people. They also know about what's been happening in the Eastern Cape with the Xhosa and so on. I mean, they know that fighting the Boers is no easy matter. So here really is a kind of existential threat. So what do you do? How do you handle this? And I think the opening moves when Retief goes for the first time is a kind of feeling out, trying to see, trying to negotiate. And the king, his advisor, saying, listen, these people are dangerous. You've got to get rid of them. And I think something else you have to understand, the Zulu have no real perception of how many they are. In other words, okay, here are the number that are over the Drakensberg.
How many more are coming?
How many are more coming? They don't know. They're not sure about that. So it seems feasible in a surprise attack to actually wipe out this whole party and be done with it. And I do believe, as you say, there are all sorts of reasons why the Zulu felt insulted, the way the Boers went on and all of that kind of thing. But in the end, simmering throughout this the whole time, wasn't the idea of a land deal. I mean, when Dingaan was negotiating with Retief, he was giving away parts of the land south of Tugela River, which he'd given to the missionary Captain Gardner as chief. So, I mean, it wasn't even his to give away. So I mean, he's not being that serious about it. We know the treaty that's signed is signed by nobody important, it seems, on the Zulu side. So it's all a game you're playing with the intention always, I think, of attacking the Boers. And, you know, we've all watched Game of Thrones and all the rest of it, and we see what happens at banquets, you know. It's the oldest story in the book. I mean, you see it get in Herodotus and all the rest of it. Invite the enemy to a banquet, kill them all, and we move on from there. I think, you know, so this is the plan. And Dingaan, when you see the his meetings with the missionary Owen afterwards, Dingaan's cock-a-hoop. He's really pleased with how clever he's been in cutting off the head and then sending off the army to finish off the rest of the Boers in their encampment. So, yeah, I think it's a fairly deliberate ploy, but one where if you are counting the possibilities to engage them in battle is not going to be an easy thing. You know that you could well be defeated. So this is the other way. Take them by surprise and eliminate them.
Well, subterfuge, it does the trick and deception.
Yeah.
As an intelligence officer in the military, I have to say that probably the truck bores in Natal were poorly served by their intelligence. Not their own personal intelligence, but military intelligence. They really, I mean, the fact that he was offering them land that was owned by the Port Natal settlers and others should have put some red flags up. The fact that the people that put their mark on the treaty were not the immediate circle of the king and his advisors, but just other Zulu. That should have been a red flag.
Yeah. Look, from the Zulu point of view, the way militarily the Zulu operated, you always sent out spies. You sent out spies often years before. Like when King Shaka was thinking of invading the Mpondo kingdom to the south, he had spies implanted in there about 2 years before he ever set out. So there were spies all over the Boer encampments, all over the Highveld. So the Zulu had a very good idea of what the Boers were doing and what they're about and what they're planning to do. On the other hand, as you say, the Boers had really very little idea of what the Zulu were about. So all the, intelligence gathering was on the one side, but not on the other.
And we see the results, what comes of it. Yeah. Now here's something that this particularly strikes a horrible chord with the Afrikaans community. Let me explain it from my perspective as an analyst, and I'll get your take on it. So they sent the impis out immediately after, taking out the wizards, as they described them.
Yeah.
And they went out to Blaukrans and Venen, and they attacked them, these wagons that were all over the place. There are only a few kraals where they gathered in, but most of them were widespread, very vulnerable, left themselves open. A hugely dumb tactical error and a degree of either naivety or arrogance that they were just safe there. But they came out and the target was to kill all of them. Now, this is in line with what the Zulu had done. It wasn't like there's the women and children going to go kill them. This was the enemy. And that includes the women and children. Yeah. And they would kill every last one of them, which is what the Zulu would do if you didn't submit to the Zulu kingdom. Is that accurate?
Well, that's right. I mean, in battle, basically you would capture the livestock, that was the prize, and mostly the women and children would be killed along with the men. You might take some women and some children captive to sort of lead a kind of captive life, sometimes even marrying into the Zulu elite and all the rest of it. But basically, you're out there to eliminate things. And look, there's another thing the Zulu always did. If you as the king took out an important chief, you executed him for some reason or another, you then eliminated his entire family and following, so there would be no one to take revenge. So in a way, having taken out Retief and his party, you have to. I mean, that is the way you do it. You take out the rest. That's the norm, if you like.
Yeah, you're almost obliged to do it. I mean, it's not exactly a uniquely Zulu trait. I mean, we saw this with the Golden Horde. We've seen this in Europe. We've seen this in the Middle East, all over. I don't want to say time honored, but a time practiced thing to do. So let me ask this question. Now, I get this a lot as an American, as political scientist, historian. Who are you to talk about South African history? My response to this one, Dr. LeBon, is often that, well, last time I checked, I'm a Homo sapien. And this is history of Homo sapiens. I am welcome to study and become involved in any human history or activity that I like to. Now, the reason I mention that is that when I talk to Zulu, almost everyone I talk to, with rare exceptions, is wholly ignorant of their history of their country. I mean, honestly, now look, I'm not throwing shade on the Zulu, but why anybody in the right mind would name an airport after Shaka? From an objective standpoint, a brutal, bloodthirsty, murdering empire builder. I mean, if you're going to do it, Cetshwayo is a far more sympathetic figure to me and a successful king. But I mean, but Zulu
but
that I've been.
Yeah, he's the founder.
That's why. Well, but I mean, that's a pretty tough way to. I mean, look, the Serbians look at the birth of the Serbian nation as the battle of the Kosovo Plojie, when they got their hat handed to them and 30,000 nobles were wiped out in 1389. Yeah. Not exactly. We have a much more auspicious start. We declared our independence and defeated the British. Yeah. But anyway, but seriously, for yourself, do you find a similar situation or do you think the Zulu are very well informed about their history and understanding? And the reason I ask that, because do you ever get any questions like, well, who are you as a white South African to tell me about Zulu history?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. When I used to lecture at the University of KwaZulu-Natal earlier in my career, I used to lecture on Zulu history, and most of those who took the course were obviously Zulu people. not one of whom had the foggiest idea about the history whatsoever. So it tends to be some, especially the more rural or old-fashioned areas, you get oral history is still being passed down. But for a modern generation, more urbanized and all the rest of it, this history has absolutely disappeared. It's not taught properly in schools. It never was. Still isn't taught properly in schools. So there is a huge lack of knowledge about their own history, in fact. But still, at the same time, one does get the question, who are you as a white person to write about, you know, Zulu history? Or who am I as an English speaker to write about Boer history? And, you know, my answer is the same as yours. One tries to be an historian. You try and read what evidence there is. You try and speak to those people you can. And you bring your own perspective to it, which, of course, is your perspective. It could be problematic. It's not the only one. History, as we know, is that famous debate without end. But there it is. If they're not going to write the history, then I'm writing the history. And if they don't like it, well, they can contest it. That's fine.
Exactly. Well, here's my view. If you don't like it, then get out there and do the research and write it yourself, you know?
Well, exactly.
Honestly, I mean, when it comes to South African history, whether it's covering the Boers or covering the Anglophone angle of it, or Tswana or Vende or Basotho, whatever it is, I think that people should feel complimented that someone else takes an interest that's not from your group in your history. Yeah. I mean, especially if it's an objective. I mean, look, I've read this book. I've not read any of your other work, but I've read this book, and I don't detect any inherent bias that is, you know, anti-Zulu or pro-Zulu. I think it's very in-depth on the Zulu. But I mean, look, that's my analysis of, I don't see it, but I mean, that's how history should be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically I was brought up in the school where, as an historian, you try to be as empathetic as you can. You try and understand what's happening from the perspective of the people you're looking at. And when you play it that way, you can see both sides and you try and explain it. And you can come to whatever conclusions you like, but one tries to be as informed and as even-handed as one can manage.
Now, your forte is Zulu history and military history of South Africa, but let me go back about a millennium earlier, okay, if you don't mind, and I get your thoughts on this. You know, I don't really care for the term colonizer. I understand, I appreciate where it comes from, but from my perspective, the Bantu speaking peoples who came south, the Nguni speaking peoples, they were also colonizers coming down the Rift Valley, and they crossed the Zambezi and then Limpopo about 1600 years ago. But before that, you had Khoi and San and other groups running around, mostly Khoi and San in Southern Africa. So when they throw that label of colonizers out, I'm like, okay, which ones are we talking about? The Bantus or the Europeans?
Well, the only truly autochthonous people, in other words, the original livers on the land were the San. Even the Khoi, in fact.
And they even migrated, yes, yes.
Yeah. So everyone except the San
should get out.
has arrived. They have, you know, taken land. They've intermarried, perhaps. They've turned the other people into serfs or servants or whatever they might be. But sure, everyone is indeed, you know, a colonist, except for
exactly. It's the history of humanity. You know, it's interesting because Liberia, of course, I worked in Liberia, rebuilt the armed force of Liberia, and Liberia has a long association with America. Mostly Liberia with America. Most Americans don't even know we have any association with Liberia. But I often get this from students at university and in graduate school. Even, you know, the only countries in Africa never colonized, and of course, Ethiopia comes up, and then they talk about Liberia. But that's total nonsense. Liberia was colonized by former slaves and free Black Americans who went to Liberia. And the very definition of colonization in my book, they imposed an alien political system in which they ruled the roost on the local population. That's colonization. Exactly. That's what colonization is.
Yeah, sure. No, Sierra Leone was no different, you know. So, I mean, it's just, No, indeed. I mean, that is the story of humanity, if you like.
Agreed. And that's exactly my point. And that's why people, I think, should get away from that label of colonizer and just talk about injustices or unfair things. I think that's much more appropriate. Yeah. In fact, speaking of that, one of my viewers just mentioned that Nando's is cheeky. You found us here, the sun.
Yeah.
It's so true, though. So true. So what sparked your interest in Zulu history? Look, I mean, I know why my interest in South Africa came about. I read James Mitchell's book, The Covenant, and that really inspired me to become a person involved in South Africa. But what got you into the Zulu? I mean, did you grow up in the area? What's the deal?
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up in South Africa and I spent a lot of time in the Zulu part of the world, but in fact, my real interest, I mean, when I was at Cambridge University, was actually India and the Indian Mutiny. I mean, India and stuff is what I see in the direction I seem to be going. But when I got a job back in South Africa lecturing, I couldn't pursue the Indian thing. And
Yeah, that's kind of like a lead, that's kind of like a lead balloon in South Africa.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, here was all this stuff on my doorstep. And I was extremely fortunate. I had a colleague, Paul Thompson, who actually he was a graduate of VMI and the University of Virginia. And so he's a military historian in his own right, of the Civil War, in fact. But he also had a job in South Africa. And we began work on the Anglo-Zulu War. I mean, the centenary was coming up, so it seemed a good idea. And it really developed from there, and I got more and more into it and wider and wider. So those were actually my beginnings, a sort of the Indian Mutiny transported into South Africa and took it from there.
Well, I suppose there's a not really an angle to it, but there are a significant number of Indians who were brought there as sugarcane workers. So there's an Indian connection there.
And they're the British, always the British.
Part
in the scene. Yeah.
In fact, they all need to take their oath this weekend to the new king, the Brits. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
So yeah. One thing as a historian that's challenging is, you know, you go to a lot of places in temperate zones or desert regions, and we can be aided. I mean, historians can rely on linguistics. That's a useful tool to follow history. We can also rely on DNA these days. That helps with history. Yeah. We can rely on more traditional things like oral history, written documents, and archaeology. But in Africa, much of the middle band of Africa is tropical, and things just don't survive in that environment. Yeah. Unless they're made out of metals or stone.
Yeah.
Now, if you go to Songhai and Mali, there are records because the Islamization took place, the literacy. Yes. And so we can trace that history that way. And there's also archaeology. In Great Zimbabwe, there's a huge settlement, which we can look at from an archaeological perspective. But the nature of kingdoms that formed up in what is today Botswana, Zimbabwe, South Africa, these are mostly, in many respects, transitory populations that moved about with cattle and such, and they didn't build permanent structures beyond thatch and wood. Is that a major impediment or difficulty, not having a good access, or is that accurate too, not having good access to archaeological evidence when you do research in Southern Africa?
Well, I mean, thank goodness for middens and things like that. I mean,
if you want to pick through refuse, but it's a very, it works.
Yeah, yeah. And places like Gungunhlovu and Ondini, they were put to the torch. Many of these great military homesteads are put to the torch. So they actually baked the cow dung and bear whole sand, etc. So you've got archaeological sites there that you actually can excavate, and you can go to Gungunhlovu, and you can actually, part of it's been ploughed and all the rest of it, but you can actually reconstruct, you know, what the Isigotlo, the Harim area looked like, and all the rest of it. So there is archaeological evidence there. In fact, it's somewhat easier for earlier periods, the very early sort of centuries before this, when people were building huts out of stone walls and all the rest of it. That's a lot easier for archaeologists. But as you say, when you're dealing with these cow dung and antbear sand floors and thatch, not that much is left. So you do depend on, you know, middens and all the rest of it. And I remember, I mean, I had a friend who worked for years at Gungunhlovu. I mean, with a fine tooth comb, picking up these tiny little archaeological bits and pieces to try and get some sense of what beads they had and, you know, what pottery they had. But there is not much in the archaeological line, in fact. No.
Well, you know, John, it's very fascinating history, not just the Zulu, but the whole region. And perhaps I get you back another time. We could talk about more Southern African military history. I mean, I'm not that familiar with your background. I know you from this book, and then I did a little research on you. Right, but does your interest and expertise extend to places like what is today Namibia and Angola, Botswana, Zimbabwe?
I've really concentrated on Southern Africa. And at one stage, I did a fair amount of work with the Portuguese in the early period in Africa as well. And certainly military history of Africa, really in the colonial period. I've not been so much modern as the colonial period. And I have looked at lots of other parts of Africa in the colonial period. And phenomenon that really interests me is the whole business of slave soldiers in Africa, for example, the ubiquity of the number of societies that depended on slave soldiers, not in Southern Africa, but especially in the Maghrib and West Africa and elsewhere. I mean, slave soldiers were absolutely basic to the number of the way a number of these kingdoms actually operated. So that's sort of a sideline I got into at one stage. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Maybe we could talk about that and delve into that one day. That's an interesting discussion. Yeah. Would you be a person that could talk informatively or authoritatively about Morosi and Baputi, I think people, Baputi people, Morosi down there?
Yeah. Not particularly, no. No, I know who you mean, but not my area.
Well, that's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the descendants of those folks are still fighting for their rights inside Lesotho today. They're still trying to claim things when they were wiped out by colonial forces from the Cape who came up there in a long siege.
Yeah. No, sure. Yes. No.
Hey, so let's go back to the Zulu before we wrap up here. At the Blood River, okay, Nkome. Right. So there's these models of the little cannon or mortars that they used, and the story is there were three of them. But I find conflicting evidence from different authors about what really happened. You got what old Gariki, I think, is the one that was brought there, and then one of them apparently it failed after one or two rounds or something like that. Do you know the story? Were there actually three artillery devices there and they had a big impact or what?
I can't be absolutely sure about it. I mean,
I don't think anybody can at this stage.
I mean, look, they're operating like big shotguns. I mean, they're not shooting cannonballs. They're shooting, canister or whatever,
Or a grape shot or something like that.
Or a grape shot. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what they're basically doing. And I'm not sure how great a part they actually played. I think far more effective was the steady rolling fire of the musketry fire, which they were able to sort of keep up a fairly steady roll of it, so that's what worked.
It's I think it's a fascinating thing, and this I will use the term mythology for the Afrikaner of the Boer mythology. Those cannons do play a mythological role in what happened there, and that's why I think it's an interesting thing in the story, but we'll never fully know, I don't think, the true story.
No, we can't. Go on.
Have you, obviously I would imagine you've been to the Voortrekker monument and seen the frieze along the wall. Very interesting, a lot of effort put into that monument.
But indeed, no. There are two marvelous new books by Schroeder and can't remember offhand at the moment, but which are two great books actually on the frieze. In fact, I could let you know. I mean, they're really worth getting. And in fact, Stanford, I know you can actually access the visuals on the frieze. So Stanford's actually got them. I'll send you that. But
please do.
But So it's. But again, it's. The frieze certainly is a very, it's of its time, it's of Afrikaner pride and at the moment when they were in there, three of the Brits, they're ruling the roost. And
they were were approaching their ascendancy of political power at that stage.
That's right. So it really is a monument to their success over the savages and the heathens and all such.
Well, I don't think the Democrats play a role in this here in America. Oh, I'm sorry. Heathens and savages. Sorry, I digress. No, but seriously. So you mentioned you're working on something else right now. What's your next work? Can you tell us, or is that like a state secret?
No, sure. It's coming out fairly soon. General Lord Chelmsford, who was a guy who messed up at Isandlwana.
He was a bit of an asshat.
Well... but he had a long, interesting career before Zululand and elsewhere. Yes. So it's a big fat book on his whole life. Really, it's the biography of a Victorian soldier of the elite, who's getting where he is, not so much because of what he does, but who he is and how he is and how patronage works and all the rest of it and how he screws it up and why. And so that's what the book essentially is about, and how, being a great member of the establishment, he manages to ride through all the scandals and failures and still ends up a courtier and you know goes into a gilded retirement. So.
And remembered in history, even though he should be consigned to the dustbin of military failure, in my view. But
absolutely. But he's part of a whole milieu, if you like, of Victorian aristocratic soldiering. And that in many ways is what the book's actually about. and what's wrong with it and why it's not so successful.
Now, let me get your take on this, because, you know, Hollywood is for entertainment, making money, but sometimes it gets things maybe not right, but not bad. Let me get your take on this. I would assume you've seen Michael Caine's first ever motion picture, which was Zulu.
Yeah, sure.
What's your take? And I understand Mangosuthu Buthelezi played in that as one of the actors there. But what are your thoughts on that movie? It's now been, gone on 60 years almost since it was produced.
Well, now, in fact, certainly in England, it's been sort of, it's fallen prey to the new sort of political environment.
So the woke environment.
So it's considered a very bad thing, in fact. In many ways, Zulu Dawn, the subsequent one about Isandlwana itself, is probably more historically accurate.
Mm.
But Zulu itself, I mean, it gets the feel of, you know, I mean, forget all the details and this and that. I think it really captures, from the British point of view, what something like that is what's actually about. I think it's very good. I mean, as I say, unfashionable as it is to be behind the barricades and be a British soldier defending yourself, it does capture it extremely well, I think. And I mean, this is why so many people have got onto the Zulu War because of that film. And
yes, and, same and here, right here.
Yeah. And it still, as I say, has this kind of, you know, status, which politically incorrect or not, is not going to go away. Yeah.
Well, for me, you know, a lot of people, the woke crowd is talking about, you know, how it portrays the Zulu poorly. I didn't come away from the movie with anything but interest and a degree of respect for the Zulu. Now, and that once I started investigating it and understanding that the impis weren't supposed to be there, they disobeyed the king, that respect declined a little bit. But yeah, the portrayal in the movie, I don't see it as particularly problematic of the Zulu. It didn't lead me to think anything. I didn't form a white supremacy group based on it, you know.
No, I don't think. I mean, again, it was really pretty well done, because for the film to work, the attacking Zulu had to seem menacing and effective.
Of course.
Which they were. So as you say, I don't see the problem, except, well, that's how things are.
Yeah. Well, with that, I have to unfortunately slip away today to go to training. I'm a judge of elections and my volunteers are getting trained today, and I have to go through their session to see what they're taught.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
Make sure we have free and fair elections. But an elected. Well, no one actually stood for the role. I went to the primaries. There was no one on the party that I vote for. And then I went to the general election. I got the ballot for the general election a few months before, and there was no one on the ballot. And I'm like, that's kind of an important job, particularly after 2020. Somebody should step forward. So I did a write-in campaign and got elected. So now I have a job, so I have to do it.
Well, enjoy it.
Well, we'll see. The election day is actually, it's a great experience. It's nice to see people participate in that. But with that, we're going to have to wrap it up here. And I want to thank you an awful lot for being so receptive. It's a pleasure here too. And I'd like to get you back on. We'll talk about some other things, if you don't mind, sometime in the future.
Great. Okay. One of these days. Absolutely. Good.
Excellent. Folks, Dr. John Laban, or as I say, Laban, because I speak German, but Dr. Laban, historian from South Africa. Thank you so much, sir. I'll let you drop off and I'll wrap up my broadcast. Thank you so much for your time.
Right. Thanks very much. Okay. Ciao.